Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge.
Hey there, it's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release, feel, and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free, and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together.
Hi, y'all. This is Angela Dunn Cartledge. You're listening to the Been There, Done That podcast, and I am here with Harold Polis, and we are going to have an amazing conversation about grief and what that looks like. I'm so glad you're here, Harold. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I would love it if you would tell our audience who you are and what brought you to the show and what you'd love to talk about today.
So my name is Harold Polis. I'm a grief counselor in Lexington, Kentucky. I serve people all over, but I am a child loss survivor. So I lost my son, my first son, Nicholas, in 2011, and I went down some really serious bad rabbit holes and wound up probably, after my first year, I just couldn't do it anymore. I tried to tough it out like men do, like, hey, you know, time will heal this and all that stuff. And I found that I was just getting worse and worse and worse. And so, long story short, after 5 years of that, I started to kind of help people who had also lost children. And I was an engineer at the time. And I kind of was kind of called to, it's kind of like when you you buy a new car, you find, you buy a Chevy and you see the same Chevy on the street all the time. I lost my son and I started meeting people just out of the blue who had lost a child. And I started helping them, walking with them in the park or whatever. They encouraged me to get a grief counseling, certification because they felt I was good at it. And so I have become a grief counselor and am serving because I really want to help people not go to the dark places that I went through my process.
We're glad to have you. And I'm so thankful to hear you reference the fact that the universe and our God brings people to us that have similar situations. And that is the exact same experience that I've had, that you end up meeting people and you think, this is not a club I wanted to be in.
Correct.
And yet here we are, not just being in the club, but now leading the club and leading meetings and absolutely, and leading people, like you said, down the path, excuse me, to try to keep them from experiencing the darkness that I think we feel because of the loneliness of it, that we, as our Western society especially, we try to talk each other out of hard things.
Yeah.
Well, don't go down that path. And hasn't it been long enough? And you know, the things that we say to each other when we're in the hard, really, really hard emotions. I know you talked a little bit about your journey just now when you were introducing yourself, but I would love to know what you can look back at now and see in that journey. What were the harder moments? What were the harder seasons, if that makes sense, of that 5 year journey? And obviously, you're never out of it, but
correct,
just out of that really acute 5 year period.
Well, first of all, it was, you know, just trying to figure out, I had a change in role. Who was I now? I still had another son. I still do, Alexander. But after Nick left, Nick taught me how to be a dad, right? Nick was my first son, and he taught me how to be a father. And after 21 years of investing and, you know, pouring myself into this kid, you know, a Montessori kid, child-led learning, all this kind of stuff, all of a sudden, who was I? Even though I had another son, it's obvious who I am. I'm a husband. I'm a dad, right? But who was I? So I really struggled with that for a long time. And that was some realization it took me. And that's where I kind of ruminated. I ruminated on that. I also ruminated on the thing that really sent me in my second year, not my first, but my second year into the journey that I took that second year, which was terrible, but was that not only did I not know who I was, but I felt that I had something to do with my son's death. Like, what did I do? Those questions. Why? What did I do? What didn't I do? What did I say? What didn't I say? What? Why? Right? All of that. I ruminated and ruminated and ruminated until I literally made myself mentally ill.
I can so relate to that. My goodness. I know I've said on previous episodes that I actually actively prayed that my son would feel better. And I didn't pray that exact prayer. Let me take that back. What I prayed was that he would stop struggling. Mm-hmm. And that same night, he passed away in his sleep. So there's a level of responsibility that we feel when we become a parent, that we somehow have to protect them from everything and teach them everything. And we do all of these things, undo the cycles that we had as children and, you know, those kinds of things. And I feel like there's a lot of pressure that we put on ourselves in that situation.
Absolutely.
Of course.
So my son died in our home. And that was another thing. I'm supposed to be a dad and I can't even protect my family in my own home. How can I be? Who am I? What am I? Right. And so to your point, we have that responsibility. And all of a sudden that felt like it was being challenged in me.
Of course. And you want that responsibility. Generally speaking, as a parent, you want to be a part of their life and them to be a part of yours and those things. That identity shift was a huge thing. And you've referenced already that you have your second son, Alexander, and I didn't have another child at the time. Mm-hmm. And that is a very, even with another child, I'm sure that there was, of course, feedback in your own internal dialogue, but also from other people. Well, you already, you know, you have another son. Pour into him. And it isn't the same thing when you have loss like that. You really don't have that same experience. Not that that child has any less of significance or love or a presence in your life. It is different. How did you take that difference and apply it then to your family? What was your moment that you were able to start to turn around and get, and I won't say remove the darkness, but sort of leave the darkness in a different zip code?
Well, so during that second year, as I mentioned, was the darkest year. So after about a year, I walked out of my, I at 3 o'clock on March 11th, I can remember the day, I shut the door at my corporate job and said, I can't do this anymore. And I left the planet. And for 7 months, I was in and out of hospitals. I was laying in the bed ruminating or whatever. And then one day, you know, there was a lot that transpired during that time. But one day I said, Lord, I can't live this way. I cannot go on living this way, because the world was passing me by and my other son needed me and my wife needed me. And I was literally broken. And I said, I can't live this way and I can't die, because I had tried. It's hard to say and give to the world, but I had tried to off myself, right? And I knew that's not really what I wanted. It was a cry for help. And I wound up in the hospital and all that, which was, I hated it at the time, but was a blessing, right? But that was the point, that I can't live this way and I can't die. So what's going to change? And it wasn't my doing. It was the Lord bringing me back. All right. And I'm happy to say that, because that's how it was. Because people will ask me, well, what changed at the end of that 7 months? And I said, I don't know. I was on the same medications. I was under the same treatment. And I just said a prayer. And about a month later, I started getting some sign of life energy again. And it took, obviously, years after that. But that was the inflection point.
I love that you are able to speak that into the world, because I also was so dark in the world that I did not think I needed to be here anymore. And that is, it's hard to admit, to your point. It's hard to say that out loud, but the fact that you are shows what you're willing to do for your clients and for your family. So talk us through what your coaching process is, what you choose to focus on and what you try to help your patients and your clients focus on.
Okay. So initially, when we have the meeting to try to see if we're going to be a good fit, right? Because this is deep work. This is deep work. So there has to be an extreme level of trust, right? So I kind of have a first call where we establish, hey, do you want to work with me? Do I feel I can work with you? You know, you got to be coachable. I've got to be somebody you can hear and trust. And how do you feel about all that, right? And during that call, I have something that I call my three pillars, right? So there's the spiritual side of us, there's the emotional side of us, and there's the physical side of us. And how do we, through your story, so this is not like rubber stamped, this is, I'm listening to this person and I'm filling out this triangle and they're doing it with me on a piece of paper. And then at the end of that call, they have something, whether they choose to work with me further or not, but that we've built, that they can, that's our roadmap. That's where we're going to start. That this right now is the four or five top physical issues. These are the top four or five emotional issues and spiritual issues. And how are we going to work through this? And it's kind of our roadmap where we start. And that evolves over time as people move through their process. But that's the cornerstone of my practice. And then it is, we just get raw, let it out. I encourage them to be as vulnerable as they would like to be. I try to build a safe container for them to be able to do that. And I find that the people who, and most people stick with that because they really felt heard. And that's one thing. You know, in this counseling stuff, we tend to get to a point where the casseroles stop, the world moves on, and we don't know what to do because we're so isolated. So just holding a space for this person and allowing them to be them and be who they need to be, and in a place where they're with somebody else and not feeling so alone, I find is sometimes really just the key to allowing them to do their work.
It's that safe container that you referenced earlier. I really, excuse me, I love the way that you named it that way, but I cannot, you saw me move my head, but I cannot agree more with the moment that the casseroles stop. When people get back to their normal lives is when you need intervention the most. That's when you feel the most alone. Mm-hmm. Because you kind of are. You're then doing the work on your own and probably not in a healthy way because you're just trying to put one foot in front of another over and over again and pretend to smile and pretend to get back to normal life. But ultimately, what I experienced, and I'd love your perspective on this, is that there is no back to normal. There's no reliving back to the way you were before because you're changed. Obviously, your dynamic has changed, your family has changed, everything about that has changed. How do you see that shift when your clients might say, but all I want to do is get back to normal? It reminds me of that moment in Princess Bride when Indigo is exacting vengeance on the person that killed his father and says, I just want my father back. Like that mm-hmm. moment when you say that out loud, but you realize that can't happen. You can't get back to that point.
Yeah. People, some refer to it as a new normal. Some people refer to it as, like you say, normal. And then there's some very astute clients that just say, it's never going to be normal. It's not right. So the way that I interpret this is like, you're trying to go on a journey that you have no roadmap for. If I'm going to the corner store, I know I got to get in my car, grab my keys, get in my car, hop in and drive. I have a map. I've just lost my loved one that I'm associated, my body, not only my mind, but my body is connected to in a spiritual way, right? And that's why grief, I think, is so hard because we have that association and we are losing that person that we knew in a physical way, right? But we have nobody ever taught us how to do life without this person. We're so used to it. So it's like we have no roadmap. We don't know what to do. And that's why I think our mind spins with trying to find out what this normal is, but we don't have a model for it in our brain. There's no model, right? And so we have to discover. And I think that's part of the grieving process is that we're discovering who we are, what we're doing, how to navigate. Like when you lost your son, how do you, all of a sudden, the world is vacant. What do I do with this, right? And so it's like you've been dropped in the middle of a forest and you're looking at the trees. You don't know what path to take. You don't know what's on the horizon. You have no clue what to do. And so it's trying to develop that map, the vision that life can still be had on after this terrible time, that we can still have a life worth living, that we can, I always use the word, first survive, then strive, and then eventually maybe even thrive, right? And so that's kind of the journey, but we have to build that map and learn, I can get up in the morning. Hey, maybe today I just do laundry. And that's going to be a big accomplishment where I'm used to kicking butt. I'm used to doing all this stuff. Maybe I only can get out of bed that day, right? So it's this new roadmap of honoring small successes and then building a momentum up.
I love the idea of building the momentum, but I see it so profoundly in my own story, and I'm sure you do too, that those moments, pardon me, those moments keep, that they change. They change from today, I'm just going to put 2 feet on the carpet. Then tomorrow I'm going to brush my teeth, you know, and those, they grow as you do.
Yeah. It's not like a billboard moment. It's
no, right.
So grass growing, watching, but it happens, right?
That's such a great way to say it, that it's such a great analogy, that it's not going to be a neon sign that shows up. It is those just 1 foot in front of another, little wiggles here and there that keep you, alive, that keep you moving, toward whatever that is that the roadmap leads you. And I particularly like the way you describe being in the woods, that, I always like to call it like you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't know which direction to swim in to get to land. Right. So mm-hmm. you're just treading water, but even treading water is working. That's keeping you moving and keeping you alive. And I love the idea of the forest because, it gives that visual idea that you can't see anything but trees. You can't see the things that are around you, the sky. You can't see the wildlife. You can't see how close you are to civilization. You just know that you're in the middle of the trees. How do we treat each other differently? How can we be better to allow those moments without creating that loneliness? Without taking away the community that is so important in these moments.
I think you just hit the nail on the head with the word community. So this is my theory, right or wrong or indifferent. It's mine. I'm allowed to say it's right because I'm not in college and have to have the exact answer anymore.
you are allowed because yes. That's what we've created today. So yes, you are absolutely allowed.
I feel that I know, let's say in my neighborhood, I know my next door neighbor, and I'm acquainted with other people, but I don't really know them. Okay. And I think that's true for many people who live in apartment complexes or whatever. You may not even know the person who's sharing the wall with you, right? But you're all there and you're in this community. But I believe in previous times, in our ancestral times, in our more tribal life or in small city life, that everybody knew everybody, right? And so if someone lost somebody, there was more of a communal sense of sharing. This person shared more, or they sat around in small groups, or they had coffee together or something, right? Or they went to the corner, even if it was in old days, to swing open the bar door in the old Western bar and drink together, right? We don't necessarily have that anymore. And I believe it's the sense of community that we've lost that helps make grief harder than it needs to be. Like in those times, people would know and help you carry it. Where now you're like isolated in your home and there's nobody to talk to because we're so busy. People are so busy. Lives are so busy. Like we said before, the casserole bit, that life moves on and it feels so unjust to us that everybody's life is normal. And ours is blown up. It's exploded. It's imploded. And everybody else is moving on. And our life has stopped. Right? So I think it's more that if we had more of a sense of community, that's why I think it's so important to have some kind of a support system, whether it's at a church, whether it's at, you know, a coffee clutch, a group of women or a group of men or something. But I think we don't have the sense of community that we used to have to help us through times like this.
It really brings to mind when we lost our son that we had a grief counselor say, why don't you join a support group for parents that have also lost? And I said, no, I don't want to be with people that are in it. I want to be with people that are through it. You never get through it, Angela. I mean, I just immediately think of that. I think of that so often, especially in talking to my colleagues on this show, that there are so many instances where I thought I didn't need that. And yet I sure did. I sure did need to know that I was not alone and that it didn't matter what dark thought, what dark emotion I was feeling, guilt, shame, responsibility, lack of identity, to your point, you know, all these things that we go through in this process, not alone.
Yeah. And I think that, to your point, it is important to not be alone and yet know that not every group works for everybody else. Like, I think it's more important to have somebody who just sits with you, who will just sit with you and watch you cry or be there with you and put a hand on your shoulder versus necessarily always having somebody to talk to. But the key is to have somebody who will listen, because so often, like we talked about in the world, people are moving on. They get tired of the story. Oh, it's been 3 months or it's been a year. Oh, you should be over this. No, no. Everybody's process is different. Some people do move faster than others, but that's not the way it works, right? And I found that when I went to a survivor of suicides, my son's death was an accident, but it's classified as a suicide, right? You know, but many people are that, but that's how it's seen to the world. So that also, before, there's a lot of judgment, I feel, you know, that parents of people who have lost somebody to an overdose or something like that, that, oh, he committed suicide or she committed suicide. There's, and that we feel a lot of judgment on that around that itself. But when we go and we go into a group, like I found I didn't function well in a group. I went to a group pretty early in my process trying to find healing. And I found that while I was sitting in the group, I know kids are reported on TV every day that die. People die every day. And I was hearing the stories in this group, and I know these people are like me. However, in my mind, I was the only one who ever lost somebody. I was in such pain that I could not participate in a way because I couldn't hear their raw stories. I was still too raw inside to even absorb my own wound, much less somebody else's, right? So I found the group didn't work for me. Now, in some ways, for some people, that does work, and that's wonderful. But for me, I couldn't do that group environment in that way because I wasn't ready. So that brings up another thing. Even no matter in our process, some people are ready to talk sooner than later. It took me 6 months to even be able to utter my son's name. I just couldn't talk about it, right? And so when we're working with people, we have to kind of wait for their window, for them to be willing to be vulnerable, to step out, to receive the help.
That's such a great point, and that there are, that we need to be clear with ourselves if something isn't working. That it's okay to say, this group isn't working for me, or I'm not a group person, to your point. But I want to go back to your judgment piece, because that was the piece that I struggle with even today. The piece of it that I potentially could have done something differently, but then the way I grieved received judgment too. I literally closed the door to my infant son's bedroom and never went back in there until we moved out of the house. You know, I never touched it. It stayed exactly the same way as it was when he passed away. And so those moments that we receive from other people, I feel create that loneliness more acutely. That we are afraid of what somebody else will say, or we're afraid of what they are going to judge about what we're doing or not doing. Are you getting rid of the clothes this quickly? Wow, that was really fast.
Yeah, mine are still hanging up there.
Right. Or the fact that I closed the door and never went back in there. Why aren't you dealing? Why aren't you, you know, making that room something else? He's not here anymore. You know, it, there's never a line that somebody isn't willing to cross and speak out into the world. And so I, what I found was that that made me more removed and more
deeper in your grief.
Yes, that I was more lonely in that because I was afraid to say, but I'm feeling this, or I want to try and have another baby, and I'm afraid of what people are going to say about that. You know, all these things that are part of our community that are just inherently part of the process. How do we disconnect from that and still have our authentic experience? Because they're all individual, just to reiterate your point.
Disconnect from the judgment. So my experience has been that I was a good dad, but, you know, part of that months where I was in the hospital was I was doubting that I was ever any kind of a good dad. Cause like I said, I couldn't protect my kid in my own house. Right. So first of all, there was that, but there's also the, so we're doubting ourselves already. Right. In many different ways. And then the world comes up and you're thinking, well, we got to let somebody know that we were a good parent. So how could I be a good parent when my son died the way he did, right? Or how could I be who I need to be, who I want to become, when I can't even, I couldn't even work with what I had, right? So there's the self-judgment. But then there's also, one of my clients said, I lost my son from fentanyl poisoning. And he said it was a 13-year secret. So it was a family secret. We didn't, you know, let the world know that our kid was a drug addict. And then when it came out, it was, oh my God, that family, that's a good family. They live in a nice house. Everything's like that. And they had a son who was a drug addict. And so they really struggled to come to terms with letting this out into the world, which was the moment he died that everybody, you know, it gets around why people died, right? So they had to really kind of ground themselves in who they knew they were. Because the judgments are going to be heaped on you, and you've got to stay in your own truth. I had to finally come to realize I was a good dad. You know, and maybe I had to go to my wife and say, was I really a good dad, this, that, and the other? And of course, there's this bantering between husbands and wives the whole time. But really, was I? Yeah. Or someone from the outside validating, you know, I wish I would have been, I wish I would be a dad like you have been. And so hearing things like that, that you, those are big moments. They're small, fleeting comments from people, but we really need to absorb those into who we are and that we know who we are, to help our own hurt.
That's so great to come back to the central point, and that is to remember who we were to start with. Mm-hmm. The lack of identity because of the loss now comes back to full circle to the point that we have to remember who we were before.
It brings up another big inflection point that happened for me. So after 5 or 6 years, I was finally back running on 8 cylinders, let's say, and life was flowing again. Life was very unhappy. Life was still struggle. But one day, I don't know when, maybe a day, maybe a week, I don't know. But I came to a point where I asked myself this question, which I think is really an important question. Do I want to live the rest of my life being defined by the event for you losing your infant son? For me, my son dying at 21. Do I want my life to be defined by that moment? Do I want his life to be defined by that moment? which it wasn't. I had 21 wonderful years, right? And that I needed to separate to a degree myself, that even before I was married and even thought about having a son or having children, I had a life given to me outside of my child. And so whether you have a spouse or a child or whoever close that you've lost, that we have a separate life that we have to grow back into, try to figure out, because we're used to having this person. But am I going to let myself be defined by this? Or that's why I got a life coaching degree too, to take people from where they are and move forward, not unpack the past, but where are we going to go from here? And move forward in life to allow you to have a life that feels like, again, a vibrant life worth living.
I love that. That's so powerful to hear, because when we're in it, there, you can't imagine that. You can't imagine creating a new life or living a new life. In fact, there's probably some emotions that come up that are, that try to block you from doing that. But that is so life-giving to hear, that you can extend from here, because you are still here. You are here. You can then take that event and be with you on that path and continue to walk.
So let's get back to the analogy on that line about the forest. So when I engage with people, I say, you know, this is your journey. I'm kind of your guide. I might have my compass and I have my, you know, way, but it's really, we're going to work with you and you're going to define this path, right? And I am your guide because I can help you realize things that when we're trapped in our grief and our mind, we can't access stuff. So my job is to help you. You have the answers within you to get through this. You're built to grieve. God gave us humans a unique skill to grieve. We're built for it. However, we need to figure that out and bring it out. And that's what I help facilitate. But you have stuff that's buried inside you, that's your barriers to get through this. And I help that bubble up and we work through it. And then you move through it. To me, that is like you're carrying your backpack. We're in the forest and you're heavy, weighed down by this backpack, right? With rocks and boulders, right? And as we go through these stages, we take a boulder and we pitch it. And that journey becomes a little lighter. And we're not out of the forest, but we've come to a clearing, let's say, in the forest. And we have a revelation moment where we've discovered something, right? And then we go back into the forest.
It's 10 o'clock.
And we keep moving forward, right? So we get to where a blue sky, we can appreciate a blue sky. We can appreciate a bird. We can appreciate simple things that gratitude, everybody, you know, gratitude, oh, that's foo-foo, that's nonsense. But it starts the ball rolling. It really does. And so we're pitching stuff out of our backpack to get to a better place.
Not forgetting, but not feeling the heavy weight and feeling bogged down by it. That's to me the best way. And I always like to talk too about, or hear, especially hear my guests talk about that moving through, the easiest way to do that is just a straight line. You know, just keep walking.
The forest is still, the path is still windy and uphill and downhill and, you know, two steps forward and one step back. Or I call it a circular staircase because you revisit stuff over and over and over. I don't go with those five stages of grief because we go through them in different ways. They're not linear, right?
And come back around to them. Just to your point, you're constantly revisiting. I've heard it, people say that you, when you get to a certain point, you have to go back and relook at the things that you've already worked on just to make sure that they're still relevant. You know, they're always relevant.
Like you say, this person was part of us. So our heart is bound to them. Even if you, let's say, go through a divorce, you can't just erase 10 years or 30 years of a life. That person is to some degree there, and you grieve that, whether you hate them in the end or not. They're still that grief, right? But when we lose somebody that was flesh and blood, or that was a really close spouse that we spent an inordinate amount of time with, right? So all that memory is stored, not just in our brain. Like most people think grieving is a brain process. It's a whole system process, right? And letting go. And we never want to let go. We don't want to forget. What we want to get to is a point where the pain of the memory of that person isn't, it gets sort of, we get back to the person who was, away from the event, away from how they died, away from their cancer sickness, away from whatever, right? To what blessing this person was. And we talked about, I said, in my son's room, I still some have some of his clothes hanging in his room. Now, instead of that room being like the most god-awful memory of him, it's a place where I sometimes go to feel him, to feel the blessing of who he was, to reconnect with memories that I don't keep captive in my mind, right? About a toy we played with, or a time we had with that toy, or something, right? And so it's the transition from never forgetting to carrying in a healthier way to allow us to go forward, right?
Yes, because we're still here. We still have loved ones. We still have things that we can do and carry that memory into whatever goes next. We're changed. We're not the same as we were before, but we are here still. There's an expectation. There's an obligation to keep going.
And sometimes they become the purpose for our life. I was an engineer. I never thought I'd be a grief counselor, but because of that pain that I went through, I want to help others not go through that. Or because, you know, the fellow who that I counseled who lost son, one of them who lost his son to fentanyl or whatever, he said, I want to help parents to not wind up in your group. So he started a group of parents of addicted loved ones to try to help them to not, or to, for parents very young. He wrote a very small book of what to watch as a person becomes a drug addict, what to watch for, how to help. It gives our life meaning to carry that person with purpose, whatever that purpose might be, right? And so some become activists, you know, like, let's say a Sandy Hook mom. She's an activist, right? Against mass shootings, right? So it can form in all different kinds of ways, but it can be a purpose beyond the loss.
We wouldn't be having this conversation if it weren't for the fact that we both had the losses that we did. I did not ever want my podcast to be about grief. That was not ever the goal. But I got asked to be a guest on a podcast, and they asked me to speak about my grief story. And I said, what grief story? I think my story is a story of resilience and a story of, well, they're just the opposite sides of the same coin. You can't have one without the other. So this was not what I expected to be talking about. But we need it. So therefore, I'm going to do it because my story led me to you, led me to so many other people that have had similar situations. So we have.
Hey there. It's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release feel and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together.
May I ask you a question?
Absolutely.
Yes. So what does resilience feel like to you?
Maybe on a different day, it would feel differently, but today it feels very much like I am commando crawling through the mud with the barbed wire above me and trying to figure out how to get through the things. Not stopping mm-hmm. is what resilience feels like. Not allowing the darkness to win. That we, Amen. I'm going to continue to move forward, even if it's in the wrong direction, because that is the beauty that God gave us, is that we do not have to stay on a path that is not working. We can change courses. We can change our minds. We can turn around and go back the way we just came. And it's about not staying still, not staying stuck in the mud.
I like too what you said about darkness, because mm-hmm. darkness, one thing I tell my clients is, so you lost this person, but darkness wants nothing more than to take you out in addition, to cause more collateral damage. So that's part of this goal. We want to help the collateral damage not expand, right? Which it often does. Yes. Marriages fall apart, people divorce after a loss of a child, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
I just want to revisit what you said earlier in the episode, where you said that we really just need somebody that will listen. They don't have to take it on. They don't have to solve it. They don't have to do anything else. They don't have to feed us. I will never forget you saying the casseroles stop, because that's so powerful. But that they don't have to do any of those things. They don't have to save us from the badness. They just have to listen, because we'll do it all by ourselves. We just need, like I said, a voice in the woods that we can sort of follow, that we can have a guide that will help us through it. That's what we need more than anything.
Yep. And it's so, and that's where I think it's important to work with somebody, because I think our society, for whatever reason, has come to that grief. We just, maybe it's a generational thing, like from the war days, World War II days, but we just have to suck it up. We just have to walk through grief by ourselves and, you know, yeah, it'll fix itself. But I found that time didn't heal my grief. That's why a year after I tried, I walked out of my office, right? But the fact that we just need to allow ourselves to have the chance to heal and to get to a different place. And with somebody who just listens and just holds space, just to acknowledge, I think that's an important thing too, to acknowledge one's pain. That if I'm working with you or you're sitting on a park bench with someone else, you're just acknowledging them and seeing them, right? We all want to be seen in life. And when we're suffering and we're so isolated and alone, we feel like we're not being seen. We feel like we're not being heard. We feel like we're just all by ourselves. And I don't think that's the way to do it. And yet society, because we don't know our neighbor, or our family lives far away where they used to be in, you know, closer locales, but that we feel so isolated. And to get through that, to have somebody who holds that space for you, is so important.
And it's life-giving. It's yeah. really is. It has been so amazing to have this conversation with you, to just validate feelings that I had 16 years ago. You know, yeah. it wasn't yesterday, and yet I'm still learning.
And I think we can both say that whereas we used to have more, let's say, bad days than good, now we have more good days than bad. We still have a very bad day now and then, a very bad day, or a very bad moment from some trigger that is, you know, deep within us. But we work through a lot of triggers, but there still are ones that hang on in there, or we hear a song, or we have something that, you know, brings us down for a while, but it's maybe a few minutes or a few hours, but not for weeks at a time. Would you agree?
I would absolutely agree. It's so critical to know that that's okay. That flip is actually just, it just means that you are functioning, that you are still here to tell the story and to love some more.
So an analogy too is, you know, we talk about the waves of grief. It comes in waves, right? Well, at the beginning, they're really tall and they're really often. And with my clients, I say, what we try to do is spread those waves out. We try to lower them and spread them out. And so what we're just talking about is now and then we get a wave. Even if you were sitting in the Gulf and sitting on your chair and the water is nice and calm, there comes a wave now and then, right? And we get those, right?
We have to get them.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. And I want them. I want memories, even if they're hard to feel. I want memories. I want to have those moments where I don't want to feel devastated, but I want to feel. I don't want to be numb.
You know, we can probably go on talking for days, but the thing you say about feeling too, that we want to feel, because in the beginning we're overwhelmed with feelings so much that we're numb, right? And then we have the painful feelings, but we do want to feel. We want to have those feelings and those memories like you just brought up. It is so important. Yeah. And that's part of the resilience, to be able to hold a feeling now that used to be terrible and see it and have a relationship with it in a different way.
Agree completely. I really do. I think that I would love to hear your definition of resilience, since you asked me. What's your definition? Fair.
I'm the podcast host here. Well, I believe it's believing in yourself. Number one, it's a building of confidence that I can get through this day, that I can pick myself up no matter what I've got, that maybe I just have to, you know, robot through it. Like at the very beginning, I do all the time. Maybe today I have to robot through it, but I know there's going to be a better day. I know there's going to be a better time. And I know that I can carry myself and function, whereas before I didn't know how I was going to hang on to my job, or I didn't know how I was going to make my marriage survive. But now we've gotten some grounding and we've gotten confidence back in our own selves that we can get through this.
We're undefeated on bad days, right? However many and zero. I like it. Talk us through how we can work with you. How can we find you and work with you and keep in touch after this episode airs?
Okay, well, I have a YouTube channel that's and it's growing. You can find me on Instagram. My Instagram handle is taming_your_grief. My name is Harold Polis. I also have a Facebook page that is Finding Peace After Passage. So three ways, and that's part of my, I guess my tagline for the way I practice. It's, you know, we want to help you find peace around the loss, where there at the beginning, there is no peace whatsoever. So we want to get you growing into a peace with yourself. So Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, podcasts like yourself, and I really appreciate you inviting me to the podcast here and giving me the opportunity for us to share in the way we have.
I'm really thankful for you being willing to jump into this little adventure of mine. And I'm especially thankful for your story and for your willingness to be vulnerable to help others, because we need it. We need it right now and more than ever. So I really am incredibly thankful for you as well. And I know we're going to help people.
Yeah. Especially with the way people don't feel they can be vulnerable because they feel like something's wrong with me, right? No, let's not normalize it, but know that we go through stuff.
Right.
Right.
Together.
Yep.